Welcome. I'd like to acknowledge the continuing sovereignty of all First Nations peoples across the country. I'd also like to acknowledge elders, elders of the First Peoples of the land, and elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to each and every one of you. And welcome to all our listeners tuned in across the country via the National Indigenous Radio Service and across the world via the World Wide Web. Welcome to you. It's great to have your company. Well, we've heard about it with the Brekkie crew, about the game last night, but it was a great game. It was a good game. And there's still two to go. And well, the Cane Toads are still the reigning champions. It's okay. I mean, you know, yeah, it was disappointing, but by gee, they had some good defence, those Blues. It was a good game, no question about it. Sad about a broken arm with Cooper Cronk and stuff like that, you know, but I don't think the stars for the Cane Toads really, they didn't shine last night, but that's all right, two more games to go. My guest today is a Murray woman based in Sydney now for some time, one of our own from up here, Leah Purcell, joining me via telephone from Sydney. Leah, welcome to the program. How are you?
Thank you. Thank you. I'm really good. Thank you. Yourself?
Yes, going well. Going well. Blue sky and sunshine up here is just magical.
Yeah, it's beautiful here too in Sydney.
Good one. Tell us your mob, your country.
Yeah, well, I'm a Gawagungri Waka Waka Murray woman. I grew up in the Waka Waka area up in Mergan and Sherbet. My family are up there and got a family in Brizzy, but my bloodline to country is Winton with my great-grandmother and Gungri Mitchellway with my nana. So true maroon, Queenslander, born and bred.
Good on you, girl, good on you. Now, you've just, congratulations are in order here. You've been awarded the Belknaves Foundation Indigenous Playwrights Award.
Yeah, that I was awarded that on Tuesday, which is just, it's awesome. Like, I've been working in the industry now for nearly about 25 years, and I've never sort of put my hand up for any sort of grants or, you know, help to sit down and write stuff. And, I just believe, you know, if this is your passion, you sit down and you do it, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, big name, no blanket, and sometimes you sort of say, you know what, if someone's, you know, has an award and wants to reward people financially for their efforts, and sometimes it's nice to be able to sit down and have that opportunity to you know, it's a bit of a luxury to sit down and to write and not worry about going out and, you know, singing for your supper or tap dancing for the rent. So it's awesome, and it's been going, it's in conjunction with Belvoir Street Theatre in Sydney, and it's in its third year. And it's about Indigenous writers across the country, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders, putting in their ideas for a possible play that they might want to do or stories they might want to develop. And this year they had a lot of women in it, and they gave special mention to four other sisters that they said the plays were really outstanding and really, you know, refreshing with the ideas and so forth. So, you know, I'm very lucky, but I'm also, you know, want to pay my respects to the other contestants in that lineup, because some of the work sounded amazing, which is great for black theatre in this country. You know, when we've got practitioners coming up with wonderful ways, contemporary styles to tell our stories. You know, we can reflect back to the past and the history in certain theatre, but there's a new movement of moving forward and telling our stories, our dreaming stories of who we are today.
Yes, now it's certainly a great achievement for yourself, and well done. Now, Belknaves Foundation, you've written a script. Or you've got a project called, it's Henry Lawson's poem, The Drover's Wife, that you presented for the for this award, for consideration. Is that correct?
Yeah. My mum was a bit of a Henry Lawson fan, and she'd always read me that short story, The Drover's Wife, because it was just me and my mum growing up. I always thought I was the little boy. If you don't know this story, it's about a drover's wife, a woman, who's on her own in, you know, up in the, well, I've placed it in the snowy mountains. I think the original story is down towards Victoria. And you know, she's a woman out there doing it on her own while her husband's away droving. And it's all about the stacking of a wood heap in the winter and a snake gets in under there but comes into the house, and it's about her having to sit up all night to look after her babies because the snake wouldn't come out. She's got five children. She's out in the middle of nowhere. But it's also about the dramas. And then in the story version, you hear her her plight of over the months that her husband's away and all the things that she has to do and look how she looks after herself. And I used to, and at the end of the story, the little boy turns to his mum, the oldest one of the five children, turns to his mum and said, "Mum, I'll never go a droving." And I used to always, and that's, and you know, although I'm the youngest of seven children, I've sort of my other older brothers and sisters are a lot older than me, so they weren't around at home. And I don't know, I always just thought it was my job to look after me mum. So, but I used to drive her mad with saying, "Mum, tell me that story. Tell me that story." She knew it so well, she could recite it after a while. So, I just always loved it, and you know, and I just thought, why not? And it's also about, I guess, another avenue for me in my acting, writing for myself, you know.
Mm.
So I hopefully want to play the drover's wife and have the wonderful Neil Armfield to direct the piece. And if at the end of the scholarship or the funding, the award, you get, it's up to Belvoir whether they want to, you know, they have the option to put the show on if they mm-hmm. wish, but they're all very excited, so fingers crossed that that happens. And but my version is I'm putting a Indigenous flavour through it, coming from the angle. So, and I'm also incorporating my dad's stories as well, who's white, and my slightly influenced by my grandmother's father. My nana was part of the Stolen Generation, and as I've been collecting stories, I found out her dad was white, but he was actually one of the fellows that actually tried to save her and pull her off the train, her brother and sister off the train when they were being taken in Mitchell. So it's sort of, yeah, I just want to honour that, I guess, you know, and that influence part of my life, you know, and who I am, I guess, my makeup. So it's exciting times. I can't wait to sit down and get into it.
All right. No, it sounds great. And also another big achievement for you is your last night. You're for the first time you've directed a main stage play down in Sydney, New South Wales. Performed at Belvoir Theatre last night, Belvoir Street, Brothers Rec.
Yeah, yeah, no, it's all happening. It hasn't. I don't think it's all sunk in yet. Maybe on the weekend, but yeah, no, the play's written by Jada Alberts, Larrakia woman, and it's a heavy little subject matter. It's about youth suicide, you know, but it's not about looking at the act. It's about what's left behind and how the family and friends have to deal with all the questions, the unanswered questions, and how, you know, different ones deal with grief. And it's such a universal topic, you know, and you know, far too common in our communities with our youth suicide. But it's a beautiful written piece, and it's, and as always with Blackfellas, there's humour in it as well. But it's five actors, and the lead is Hunter Page Lockhart, which is Stephen Page's son from Bangarra, and Radawoy Hick from Nullumboy way up that way, Nyungor girl. It's a great little piece that we opened last night, and full house, and my first play as a director upstairs. So there's about, you know, nearly 400 people, and it was really awesome. You know, the cast did a fabulous job. And I'm still pinching myself, I guess.
Yeah, you would be. No, well done. That's fantastic. Now, Brothers Rec, Jada Albert, she was last year's recipient of Belknaves Foundation Indigenous Playwrights Award.
Yeah, she was. So I guess this is, you know, this is a good example of the process working. Part of the process and the finances is that you are mentored by staff at Belvoir, the literary manager and the associate director for new works, and they just guide you and give you notes and in regards to your script work and you know, as a support team as you sit down and write. And then Jada was you know, it's amazing for her, first time rider, to have your play, you know, put on in the upstairs Belvoir. It's a big deal, and you know, to be a part of her journey. In bringing it to the place fruition, you know, just, yeah. So it's a really awesome time, I guess, in the industry for Indigenous practitioners, you know, across the board, you know, with the success of Redfern Now, Gods of Wheat Street, you know, you see a lot of mob now popping up in various other just mainstream television. So it's, and we're, you know, we're moving and shaking, and it's time, you know, I think it's all panned out at the right time. We couldn't have come, you know, of course, all our elders that, and our peers that
pioneers,
went before
us.
We're laying the groundwork, and it's really great that, you know, there's all, we're still feeding that momentum and empowering each other, which is awesome.
And we lost one of those pioneers last week. Jerry Bostock passed away, and he's one of the early pioneers of theatre and film and stage work, isn't he, Jerry?
Yeah. No, absolutely.
Him and Big Brother Lester back in the black theatre days. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, no, it's always a loss when we lose the pioneers and so forth. But we just hope that, you know, us as younger generations, we're making them proud.
I think so. Yes, I'd say you're certainly making. My mother would be proud. She's another one of the pioneers of those early days. She'd be smiling at this news, you know, of your achievements and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. No. Absolutely. That's what, you know, that makes what, you know, makes you what keep going. You know, because I guess there was no fundings or awards back in those days, and it was pure adrenaline and passion for the industry and passion to tell our stories. And you know, it's great to let them know that it's, that energy has been filtering down and what inspires us.
For sure. Belknaves, this is only the third year of Belknaves. What's the, I don't think I asked you the background of Belknaves, did I? Did you tell us what Belknaves
is? They're a family, and Neil Belknaves, he owned a television station, so his finances came through that, and I actually worked for him back in 1996 on Police Rescue. He was the producers that was, you know, putting on Police Rescue and Fallen Angels. So in my speech I said, oh well, thanks for my check back in those days, and thanks for the new one, and I hope to keep with the family. But they're a big supporter of the industry, and absolutely a massive supporter in Indigenous arts, and they've also, you know, put in finances to other projects here in Sydney. So they're an awesome family, and really respectful to Indigenous culture, you know, people, and but especially the industry, and they really want to support, you know, up and coming, or even, you know, with me being a bit of an old stalwart now, the experienced ones, and that's great too, you know, that it's about the idea, it's about the person's ability in what they're supporting and wanting to push to the forefront. So we're very lucky to have them, and they're very, very lovely people.
Now, you're the 2014 recipient. The 2013 was Jada Albert, and 2012 was Nakia or Nakia Louis?
Nakia Louis. Yeah, Nakia Louis. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. No, they're once again, you know, they're Nakia and Jada, first time writers, but I think writers with absolute great potential, and you know, I hope they have the passion to keep going, and I'm lucky number three. My grandson's favourite number is three, so I'm lucky about that. And because it was funny, because it was a bit of a spare of the moment. I'd been chipping away at the script. I've got the first sort of rough draft of Act One, and I sort of got a phone email to say, you know, two more days before the deadline, and I said, oh, you know what, I might do this. So
last minute stuff.
And I didn't know whether they took adaptations of plays. You know, it's a Henry Lawson's short story, and I'm adapting it. But they said, no, we love the idea, we love the concept. You know, massive fan of Henry Lawson. I'm really looking forward to where you take the Indigenous, you know, component in it. And And, you know, I'm keeping sort of, if people know the story, I'm keeping quite respectful to the main story, but it's the stories that influenced the drover's wife. She's part Aboriginal, as they say. It's set in 1898, and she sort of discovers through another Aboriginal character, through my research, that and the story of an Aboriginal man comes to the hut, you know, saying that he'd stack her wood heap for her for a feed, you know. So I'm just, and then the great thing about theatre and you know, when you're writing for film and television, is you can, you've got creative license to open these stories up and go anywhere, really. So there's always a twist in there. I've got a little one, but I'll keep it good to one. Myself at the moment and see if it pans out.
Good one. And how much time do you have for this to finalise it and to get it out in the theatre?
Yeah, well, I think it depends on each individual, you know, story, play, and where the person is at. But, you know, there's a lot of interest, and people were saying to me, you know, do you want to, how about January next year? And I went, hey, hang on, I've got to write that end bit yet. So, look, it can happen as quickly as that, or, you know, the latter part of, you know, 2015. So I'm just, you know, I've got to go in for a meeting and set it all into motion, as they say, and get on with it. And, you know, so, but it's just, it's glorious because it takes so much pressure off. Because, you know, I'm freelance, so every, you know, I've got to go out and sing for my supper. So it's really nice to know that, you know, for a month there, I can sit down and just really, really write this and you know, not have to get in the flow of writing, because I'm one of those writers that when I sit down, I just sit and I go, you know, until I, you know, throw, you know, spill it all out and write it all down. So it's nice to know that I don't have to, you know, run off and do something else, and I can really focus. I'm over the moon about it and feel really, really blessed to have this.
Yeah, no, so you should feel that way. When you're writing this one, for example, Drover's Wife. When you're writing that, do you have in mind, oh, gee, this one would be the ideal woman here, and this bloke would be the ideal lead? Do you have people in mind? Don't have to tell us who they are or anything like that, but do you have these sort of people in mind when you're writing? And
I do. Like, I've got a couple of, you know, I've got a feature film that I've been writing on for ages, and I have the girls in mind. For Drover's Wife, you know, absolutely. I have the actors in mind, you know, and it just allows you, well, for me, it allows, I'm very visual, so it allows me to visualise it and, you know, what a tall man could do as opposed to someone of shorter stature, you know, just physical things that, you know, okay, yeah, that could happen, and, you know, and then, you know, the glory of casting wonderful, wonderful people to be involved, and it's also people that I probably, you know, would like to work with in the future or down the track, or someone that I've seen work and think, wow, you know, to help someone's career along and all of that sort of stuff. It is exciting. Sometimes, you know, they say, oh, you know, that could limit you, but I don't think so, because you're not writing their person, their character, you know, who they are as an individual. You're actually writing something because you've been influenced by a performance that they've done, or you know that they could grab that character and really do something.
You're writing something a character for these people that'll fit into it, Where to after? You work on the script the whole thing and have it ready to roll. You got to chase money. You got to go somewhere else in to say, "All right, this is ready."
No,
what happened?
Yeah, no, that's all Belvoir. That's the, you know, Belvoir. If Belvoir don't like the end product, then they don't have to put it on. Mm-hmm. You know,
all right.
That's when. Yeah, so
this is part Belvoir, of the part of winning this award now.
Yeah, yeah, so and you know, Belvoir, they get first. Yeah, they get first option, as you say. So, but, you know, and that's when you do, say, if they say, you know, Leah, you know, good on you, but we don't want to put it on, then I can go out. But the script is mine, and I can go out and you know, give it to people to read, you know, and see if the festivals are interested or another theatre house. But, you know, one of the festival guys at the, you know, when they did the announcement, he was the one that came up and said, oh, well, I've just told Belvoir we're looking at January. And I said, oh, great, yeah. Okay. So it's nice, you know, it's nice to be loved. It's nice to be wanted. And it's nice, you know, because I've been around for a while now, and it's nice to know that people want your stuff, you know, whether you've been around for 5 minutes or 50 years, you know, it's nice when people go, we know that we're going to get a good product out of you because of, you know, your past record. So it was really nice. Nice acknowledgement, you know. But you can get jaded in this industry. It's a lonely place and it's hard. It's hard. It's cutthroat. So,
oh, yeah. A very fickle industry too.
Yeah.
Tell me, you're singing. You have a beautiful voice. You have done a little singing. Any plans to develop that or any recording studio?
I miss it. It was something that had to give. You know, there's only so many things you can do all at once. And the music industry, it's such a tough one. And especially because I had a band back in the day. So there was other people's lives that sort of I was influencing. And, you know, it got to the point where, you know, they, the band and the punters sort of said, well, you're going to get serious and bring out records or, you know, what's going to happen here? So, but just at that stage, my acting was really taking off and I said, I really need to focus on that. So I put it on the back burner for a little bit. But, you know, I did a play in 2011 now, I think, December into January 2012 with Belvoir and the Downstairs, and I was a co-adapter on a book, Aunty Ruby Langford Guinnaby's first book, Don't Take Your Love to Town, and we turned that into a monologue, two-hour monologue, and I performed it. So I put some singing through that, so, you know, and still got to blow the pipes there for a little bit, but I do miss it, you know, that music element, and I'm always thinking about it, so it's on the list to do. Not sure when, but I'd love to, you know, get back. I grew up on country and, you know, and it seems to be every song I sit down, whether I'm in the shower or, you know, in the kitchen washing up, sing a few country songs. And I said, you know, it's on the to-do list, you know, when I'm not sure, but I'd love to get. Yeah, I do miss it.
When the time's right, it'll happen.
Yeah, when the time's right, you know.
Yes.
It'll all fall into place, hopefully. You can only, you know, it's no harm in dreaming.
That's right, yes. Now, some of our younger ones, other people in the community have dreams about acting or writing or production in the arts. What do you say to people that have some talent and are a bit uncertain or wondering what to do? Do they need to go to places like NIDA? Do they need agents to do to book them and stuff like that? What do you say to young ones that might have dreams this?
It's always a tricky industry, and you know, it's I was very fortunate to have in regards to how I started in the industry. But as you get older, you know, you think I did on the job training. But we've got some wonderful places where our young people can go and learn the industry. So you're not as naive as what I was when I stepped out. And you know, it's good to have that knowledge because then you don't feel so fearful. You know, I was very fortunate. My first play was, you know, Your Mum Wrote through Murray Eyes with only Kathy Fisher directing it. I was around Murray's. I felt safe. I felt secure, and which allows you to perform at your best because you got that support. So I would say, you know, if it's your passion and you're hungry, getting that education in the industry will take you further, but it just gives you an understanding. So when people are talking technical to you, you're not doing what I'm doing and just nodding my head, bluffing, and then ringing someone else later and go, what do they mean by that? You know, back in those days, I think I owned Telstra because the amount of phone calls I'd be ringing home to Mergan going, oh, these people are talking about this, and like they knew, you know, they're Mergan mob, but you know, it was just someone I could ring and discuss. And I've had a wonderful partner in Bain Stewart, who was always great and very supportive. In doing that. But I do encourage young people to, if they have that passion, to do something. You know, life's too short to sit and wonder, and it's no harm in just trying, you know, no matter what it is. You know, if it's coffee making, if it's being a police officer, if it's being a judge, if it's working for the council, you know, it's just about doing something with yourself to motivate and to say that you had a crack at life,
Yeah. So make an effort and don't lose sight of your dreams, but have a go. Give it a good shake.
Yeah. And, you know, we can all sit down. If there's stories you want to tell, you know, people say, oh, but shouldn't I, you know, be this? And I said, yeah, you can. I said, but the first thing you got to do is just sit down and go once upon a time and write it and see where it goes, you know.
Great news with David Gulpel in Cairns this week.
Amazing,
yeah.
Eh?
Yeah, fantastic.
Amazing.
Yeah,
tear to my eyes.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Oh, it's so deserved. When I'd done Lantana and Jindabyne, they always talk about the subtlety in filmmaking, and I wasn't, did a good job, but as an actor, you sit back and you pull your performance apart.
Yeah, yeah.
And because you always strive, and that's my motto, I strive for perfection. I never want to get there, because that's the day, kicking up the daisies and you move on. But it's about striving for perfection. And I remember someone said, when I watch in Rabbit Proof Fence, and when he's walking through the water, Gammon tracking those girls, and he knew where they were, and they were there, and they pan up to his eyes, and you just know with one little look that he's letting them go, And I went, now that's a master. I just had a master lesson with David Gulpel, in subtlety. And I took that away with me in the next little projects I did, I'd remember that and practice, those kind of things. It's just, he's a, phenomenal man and what he's done for the industry, and it's, good on Rolf De Heer, the director. He worked with David in Trackers, in 10 Canoes, and he was the first, he's probably the only white director thus far that has credited our mob in their truth in the roles that they played. Like, when you read the credits for 10 Canoes, he's like fourth on the list. There's all the mob that he got the story from before him, and he called himself a co-director. And, that's what it should be when it comes to our stories, They are ours, and we should be credited as such because we are oral giving, So I take my hat off to him and the stuff that he's done for David and his family and his community up there. He's a great, great man, Rolf, and I hope, I can't wait till Charlie's Country comes out. I don't know if, people to YouTube the clip. I think you're going to see David Gulpel in a role that we've never seen him in before, and
really?
It's exciting.
Yeah.
It's exciting, and, very exciting times.
All right. Well, you've got other commitments. I really appreciate you joining us today to talk about your endeavours, your achievements. It's really good to have you.
No, always a pleasure.
Fantastic.
And just wanted to give you're the first one I've spoken to really about the Bell Nose, so, got to keep the home state out in front. Not like the boys last night, but that's all right. We've got to give New South Wales something to hang on to. Hey?
Give them a dream to hang on to pursue, to work for. Yes,
that's
of course.
Yeah.
You're right there. Okay, Leah. Thank you very much, and good luck with it all. It was just fantastic to see you powering on like this. Thank you. Have a great day.
Thank you. Love to family up there. Thank you.
Will do. Bye. Thank you. Bye now. Now my guest, Chris Graham, editor of New Matilda. And people, you've got to subscribe to New Matilda. Google N-E-W-M-A-T-I-L-D-A, New Matilda. Google that. But you've got to subscribe, support this fantastic, independent, investigative journalism has taken place with New Matilda these days. And Chris, welcome to the program. How are you?
Thank you, Tucker Bowles. I'm
working
alive.
Hard. Working hard.
Yeah, I am working hard. This is the hardest I've worked in weeks.
Good on you. Good on you. Good to see.
Yeah.
Give us an update on the White House gate situation.
Well, look, we'll be putting a story up later today or tomorrow possibly. We're working on other stuff, but The latest, if people don't know, it's the story about the White House Institute giving the Prime Minister's daughter a secret $60,000 scholarship We revealed earlier this week that and the Prime Minister and White House have maintained that that scholarship was on the basis of merit. But we revealed earlier this week that the only other person that we can identify who has received a scholarship in the 25-year history of White House, of this level and this value, is a young woman called Billie White House, who is the daughter of the owner of White House Institute. So so there's two that we know of, the daughter of the Prime Minister and the daughter of the owner of the business, which makes these claims around awarding of scholarships on merit quite difficult. It's pretty clear they were actually awarded on the basis of genetics, not merit. The story we'll update today is that White House, and this is a scoop, Tiger, we haven't published this yet, but
really?
White House have come back to us and they said, no, that's wrong. We never awarded Billie White House, the daughter of the owner, a scholarship. She just happened to study here free of charge.
All right. So there is a difference, you see. Yes. Okay.
I was wrong, Tiger.
Yes.
It wasn't a scholarship. You were wrong. It was just a freebie.
I just made space for a freebie for her.
That's right. So
all right.
I kid you not, that is their response, and that is... When I read it, I thought I'd misread it. I thought, no, they're not going to argue this. But they are. They're saying that it wasn't a scholarship, it was just a free education.
And only two, and neither of them would have been on merit. Well, certainly the Abbott one doesn't look like Francis Abbott.
Well, they're genetics, Tiger. Exactly, it's as simple as that. Genetics. They won the scholarships on the basis of genetics. Yes. I've seen this document, you know, a meme doing the rounds. That it's very cleverly done. It's an application form for a scholarship at the White House Institute, and it only has one question, and it just simply says, "Who's your daddy?" And then it says at the bottom, "We'll consider your application and get back to you shortly." So you just have to tell them who your daddy is, and that's the basis on which you may or may not get a scholarship. The evidence is overwhelming that it wasn't based on merit. I mean, not only, I should add, did Francis Abbott receive a secret $60,000 scholarship that was never advertised prior to its awarding and was never published or revealed publicly after its awarding. It wasn't even revealed to senior staff at the college. It was kept completely secret. But she also managed to score a job at the White House Institute when she finished her Bachelor of Design.
With no job description.
We got leaked some documents which show of the 74 employees at this institution, only one has no job description in their register, and that is one Francis Abbott. So,
where there's smoke, there's fire.
Well, look, that's true, but I would suggest that this isn't smoke. There's a bushfire raging around there.
Where can this go? You're flushing out people and exposing them as liars. There's no other word for it but liars. Is that correct?
Well, look, my legal advisors would suggest I use the term people who haven't been entirely forthcoming with information.
Right,
that would
okay.
be my... I've got to accept the legal liability these days.
Oh, of course. I have to be a little mindful myself.
Indeed, you do.
So, we don't call them liars. Okay.
In Abbott's defence, I don't think it's defamatory to call Tony Abbott a liar.
But where can it go to? I mean, what's the worst thing that can happen here? You're exposing them and showing them up. Abbott,
well, look,
and
there's some,
White House.
There's some significant problems for them because the federal government has put forward legislation in February this year which seeks to basically gut the federal government regulator that regulates these private colleges and make sure that the degrees that they offer, the courses they offer, are of a standard that we would all hope, i.e., if you're going to pay $68,000 for a scholarship at this place, or for a degree at this place, and that's what you will pay, the federal government regulator is the one that makes sure that the education you are being delivered is of a high standard. Now, in February, Christopher Pyne put up legislation to gut this regulator. They've been absolutely open about it, and one of the one of the points in the explanatory memorandum that accompanies this legislation into Parliament makes the point that if you gut this regulator, the level of political interference in these things will increase. And that's a major problem for the government because, on the one hand, they've delivered a budget that causes the university fees or higher education fees to go through the roof. They've also increased, or they will increase, the interest rate on people who've already got student loans. So people are going to be paying much, much more for their education, in some cases well over 100% increase. And the people who will benefit most from this, or the organisations who will benefit the most, are private colleges, where there's expected to be an influx of students once the legislation comes through. Now, what is problematic for Abbott and the government is, number one of the private colleges that benefited gave his daughter a $60,000 free kick. Number two, Abbott never disclosed that information on the members' interest register, which is the register where he must disclose benefits that he or his family receive as part of his time in office. That was never disclosed, Tiger, and that is problematic for Abbott. He's saying he's got advice he didn't have to because it was based on merit. It's clear it wasn't based on merit, so the obvious question is, when are you going to update your register? And the other problem they've got is, and this is, we're looking at this at the moment, is how does the system work at a federal level in terms of lobbying? Are private colleges lobbying the Liberal Party to get these sort of legislative advantages? And I think you'll find we'll have something more to report about that a bit later today. But it's where it will go, Tiger, I think, is a fairly... I think the best we can hope for is a very rigorous investigation into how this legislation came about and who will benefit from it and who's been in the background trying to get the legislation up.
Manipulating things, all right.
Yeah, it really fundamentally, there's a lot of irony in this story because you remember this budget that they handed down, they said this is the end of the age of entitlement, yet the Prime Minister's daughter is getting a $60,000 secret scholarship in the background.
Yes.
But if we accept that this is the end of the age of entitlement, why is legislation being pushed through that will benefit those who are already entitled and privileged?
Yes.
It's very problematic for the government. I think they've bitten off a lot more than they can chew on this because it used to be the case that university was, you know, for the elite. It was a place where only those either with the brains or the money could go. Tertiary education and tertiary qualifications is becoming much more accessible and considered by Australians almost to be a right. If you tinker with that right and if you tinker with the capacity of people to access tertiary education, I think you're walking a very dangerous political line, but that's what they've done.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see what you come up with later today or tomorrow.
Yeah, next issue. Later today or possibly tomorrow.
Next issue. The super principal at Moree, Hilton Humphreys, he was arrested after appearing in court and more charges laid.
Yeah, look, it was quite dramatic according to the reports we've had. He appeared in court on Monday in Moree at the local court for the ongoing matter related to his alleged indecent assault of a 10-year-old girl in his office last year. Now, he was charged with that, and you and I have talked about this, Tiger, on air. He was charged with that in February this year in Armidale and bailed to appear in Moree, and that court process has been ongoing. When he appeared on Monday, he walked out of the court and was confronted by detectives on the steps of the courthouse, where he was rearrested and taken to Moree Police Station, where he spent the whole day. That night, they charged him with four additional matters, which was three counts of aggravated indecent assault, the victim's age 16 or over and under the authority of the offender, and one count of aggravated sexual assault, which is, you know, in the old parlance, rape. And that victim, same victim, aged 16 or over and under the authority of the offender. So he's now facing a total of 6 charges related to sexual or indecent assaults.
And that's some serious jail terms for them, I imagine, if found guilty?
Well, if found guilty, yeah. They're very serious offences. Mm. 2 of them relate to a child. 1 of them relates to someone who's not a child. But one of the interesting things, I think, is that... Well, there's a couple of interesting things. One is that this guy, Hilton Humphreys, is a super principal. That's a term that the government coined to describe Hilton and a few other principals in New South Wales who earn well in excess of what a normal school principal would, because they're part of a hand-picked group of principals sent into communities with high Aboriginal populations to try and get some better educational outcomes in those communities. It's part of the New South Wales government policy called Connected Communities. So in short, this principal, in the words of the New South Wales Education Minister, Adrian Piccoli, is one of the best that money can buy. But he's now facing a string of very serious indecent and sexual assault charges, which begs the question, Tiger, how did this happen? I mean, the man is entitled to the presumption of innocence, but and we'll have to wait and see that go through the court. He is the trial for the alleged indecent assaults against the 10-year-old girl will start to proceed in August, on August 12 in Moree Local Court. The new fresh charges of sexual and indecent assault against a person who wasn't a child, they will be on that. You know, we don't know when they'll proceed, but probably later this year sometime. Mm. But in the meantime, Tiger, this man is still the principal of the high school. He's certainly not working. He's on leave, according to the documents really? We've seen from the New South Wales Education Department of Education. And look, he is entitled to the presumption of innocence. He hasn't been convicted of anything. He's just been accused of it. But where New Matilda, it was Tracker, was looking into this, but now obviously New Matilda is looking into the broader issues around the Connected Communities policy, and I think we've talked about this as well, Tiger. I can tell you what we know so far is not pretty at all. The policy is in serious trouble, and there have been very serious problems cropping up at various schools. There's 15 in total. We've looked at quite a few of them, and there's some significant problems around not just educational outcomes, but around the leadership of some of their schools.
All right.
Okay. So it's one to watch. We'll break it in the next few weeks. We'll start breaking stories on this in the next few weeks. I mean, we've been reporting this matter around Hilton Humphreys for some time because, you know, it became a public matter through the court system. But in the background, we've been doing a lot of research on what is actually going on with the Connected Communities policy. And it's a really important story for obvious reasons. This is about a radical New South Wales government policy aimed at lifting First Nations kids in regional and remote New South Wales out of their educational disadvantage. They're spending a lot of money on this policy, and you would hope as a taxpayer that you get some return for that expenditure.
We'll see what
comes of it all. But the other really interesting point, Tiger, is that Hilton Humphreys, the man facing these charges, is the cousin of Kevin Humphreys, who is the New South Wales Minister for Western New South Wales. The reason I make that point, it'll become clear down the track why there's a interesting link, but it's just one to watch at the moment. There's no suggestion whatsoever that Kevin Humphreys has done anything wrong, but there'll be some interesting stuff coming out on that down the track.
Mm. Okay. Mm. Next issue, the Federal Attorney General, George Brandis.
Chicken George, we call him.
Yeah?
Well, we called him Chicken Little George because he was basically running around suggesting the sky was going to fall in if he didn't amend the Racial Discrimination Act. Now we're calling him Chicken George because he's apparently decided to water down his amendments, so the Sydney Morning Herald reports.
All right.
For those who don't know, obviously Andrew Bolt was belted in. Andrew Bolt, a very conservative columnist for the Herald Sun in Melbourne, was belted in court a few years ago by Larissa Berendt and Pat Etock and others, Mark McMillan, over a series of columns he wrote which alleged that First Nations people were only identifying as First Nations people so that they could gain some sort of economic advantage over other people. The story was, unfortunately for Andrew Bolt, the story was littered with errors, and it was also found by the federal court to be a malicious story. It wasn't written with good intent, it was written with malice, and it was wrong. So it was indefensible, basically. And it was found to have breached the Racial Discrimination Act, in particular Section 18C of the Racial Discrimination Act, which talks about or prevents people from insulting, offending or inciting hatred against people on the basis of their race. The federal government's always maintained, or the Liberal Party's maintained, that they will remove 18C from the Racial Discrimination Act if they won office, and that's what they set about doing. Unfortunately for George Brandis, I don't think he, who's the Attorney General who's doing this, I don't think he predicted the level of opposition that he would get. And this is one of those rare occasions, Tiger, when the blackfellas are getting done over, but it turns out it's not only the blackfellas who are getting done over, it's a lot of whitefellas as well, including people of Jewish descent who are regularly subjected to, you know, hatred on the basis of their religion. So a lot of people have united against this. People of colour have united with First Nations people. The Jewish community has united with First Nations people, all in opposition to George Brandis's mooted changes. And it really has caused the government quite a lot of grief. And internally, there's a lot of reporting that George Brandis is just regarded as crazy on this. That I read one backbencher's comments that George had been drinking from the Kool-Aid container on on this stuff. So they basically don't have much support in the community, and they don't have much support within the party. So they are George Brandis is now reportedly looking at watering down his amendments to the RDA.
All right.
Which begs the question, Tiger, what was the point of all this? I mean, how much taxpayer money have they spent on George Brandis's Boys Own Adventure to bolster the ego and the reputation of a columnist who was found to have acted maliciously and inaccurately in the Herald Sun? I mean, you know, again, Tiger, this is another story about privilege and how power works in Australia. If you are someone with a voice, you're going to get looked after.
They're certainly good at exposing themselves. White House situation, this situation, the Andrew Bolt legislation that it was known as early in the piece, you know?
Yeah, look, they really have, I think, blown it, the Liberals. Yeah. They had, the thing is, it's always true that government, oppositions don't win government, governments lose government. That's always the case. That was particularly the case at the last election. Labor was so odious and such a bad government that people had really felt they had no option but to vote ultimately for the Liberals. But there was no question that Tony Abbott was regarded as a very unpopular opposition leader, and I think that's all coming home to roost now. The Liberals seem to have been emboldened by the size of their win, and they've moved quickly to put their ideological stamp on everything that they do. But turns out a significant proportion of the community doesn't like their ideology. So I think they're in serious trouble, Tiger, and it's getting worse. I mean, every day there's a new story about how they've buggered something up. Yesterday, late yesterday, Christopher Pyne was out saying that the government would be collecting hex debts from dead students. Today, Tony Abbott is out hosing that down, saying, no, we won't do that. Yesterday morning, a video emerged of Joe Hockey at a series of protests, I think in 1987, protesting against the increase of university fees. Well, he's the treasurer who just spiked the university fees through the roof. So every day, Tiger, something is coming out that is doing these people damage. And frankly, I can't see it stopping anytime soon, Tiger. I can't see them getting any clear air for a while, because I can tell you we know there's some more to come from our end, and there's journalists everywhere out there trying to ferret information. So
great. That's what we're needing.
To roll on.
A one-term Abbott government.
It could be, Tiger. It could be. Look,
keep your
fingers
crossed.
Too far out to say, but it could be. I remember predicting that too, Tiger.
You did?
In October last year.
Very good.
Well, we're about... the first time I've been right on something like that.
We're about out of time. I suspect we'll probably be in touch with you next week and see what's happening with New Matilda.
Yeah, it'll be a wild ride. That's my only guarantee.
Very good. That's what we like. You take it easy, thanks. And thanks for joining us at short notice.
Pleasure as always. Thanks, Tom.
You have a good day. Bye now. Chris Graham, editor of New Matilda, joining us. You join me tomorrow for Let's Talk on your local First Nations station.